Well, I hope you found last week's kind of introduction to conscience interesting. As I said, these are all things that we kind of know about, but we don't totally think through today. I think some of that is because we live in an age of materialism. And so we tend to think of many of the actions of the soul more in terms of physical things. Lust is not necessarily something your soul does, it's something your body does. Thinking is something your brain does. It's the synapses firing off in your brain. No, it's not your soul, right? A previous generation would have actually looked maybe not chiefly to the soul, but they would have seen that as equally having a role in all that. And so it's very good to really slow down and consider these things. And we'll see this as we go. It just starts popping up more and more. You'll perhaps as you study this, you'll be like, man, conscience is kind of everywhere. Paul talks about it a lot. They all talk about it a lot. So just to recap very briefly, we saw last week, conscience is much more than simply feeling guilty. It's not even technically speaking a feeling that you've done something wrong. We'll see today that it produces or it affects certain what we call passions within us. But those passions are caused by conscience, but they aren't necessarily conscience itself. Furthermore, we saw conscience is a faculty of the soul, which resides in the mind. Just as the mind is that faculty of the soul's ability to know or to determine truth, so also our conscience is that which knows with us and determines whether our actions were sinful or whether they were right. And so really, conscience is that which judges ourselves. We may know of someone else's guilt, but conscience doesn't condemn, our conscience doesn't condemn someone else. It condemns us if it does condemn. And I like just William Ames' definition is really good. Conscience is man's self-judgment in many ways. We could say the faculty of man's self-judgment, okay? We saw that conscience essentially does two things. It either accuses and condemns, and this is kind of twofold. It accuses, it condemns not just the action, but by relation of the action, then the person, right? What you did was wrong, ergo you are a sinner. Right, you are condemned because of this. Or conscience excuses and acquits or even comforts, we could see. We saw that this is true primarily of past actions, that the memory works with the conscience to bring back things to the fore of our mind, but it can also be true of future actions as well. When we know we're going to do something wrong, even then our conscience tells us that what you're about to do is wrong. And even then, there's a sense of condemnation in that. And then lastly, we saw that ultimately, and we'll see this more and more as we really get through this, ultimately, the blood of Christ alone can give a guilty conscience peace because it alone can justify sinners in the sight of God. We'll see that there are all other attempts by man are merely attempts to numb the conscience or to lie to it. But they cannot actually give true peace to the conscience. Only that can only be done by the blood of Christ. Okay, well today we're going to dive deeper and analyze conscience and how it functions even more. Particularly, what happens in our own souls when our conscience either condemns or accuses us? We know that there are two duties, to condemn or to excuse, but what exactly does that look like? What takes place in the soul when that happens? Let me ask you guys. Let's say your conscience accuses you of something you did. Maybe you spoke too harshly to your child, to your husband, to your wife. Your conscience, therefore, accuses you of it. What happens then inside you? What happens? You feel sad? Okay. Anything else? That's definitely part of it. Yeah. Yeah, that's one thing you can do. Yeah, definitely. And we'll see later, much later, that confession is a very important part of clearing the conscience. What else, though? What else takes place in the soul? Let's say you did something really bad. Let's say you really messed up. What do you feel inside you? Just sadness? Conviction, okay. What's conviction? Okay. Okay. What else? And I'm teasing because some of these things are a little intangible, though we know what they are. What's conviction? To feel convicted? I don't know exactly how to describe it, but we know what it is, right? Well, all these things are, you're kind of getting at all the right things there. What we would say technically happens in the soul, and remember, as this is why I said it's important to have a discussion of the faculties of the soul. You have the mind, the will, and the affections or the passions which are attached to the will. What happens when your conscience accuses you is it stirs up and produces passions within you. Okay? Now remember, passion is a technical term. It's not like, well, I'm very passionate. A passion is more or less a disordered affection. So there are all kinds of affections that we should have that are good. Love, kindness, joy. These are all like affections. A disordered affection is that which is produced in you. It's disordered. Lust, jealousy, sinful anger. These are all things that are produced inside you. They're not really part of the mind. They're connected to the will, okay? William Perkins says, the effect of the accusing and condemning conscience is to stir up sundry passions and motions in the heart, okay? Let's see. Now, he goes on to basically give us five. And I'll kind of toy with these a little bit. We'll see. I think he gives us basically the right number. Also, keep in mind, these are not nice, neat, and tight categories. They kind of blend into one another a little bit, as we'll see. But nevertheless, they are rightly distinguished. Okay? Perkins says that there are five of these. He says, the first is shame. The first is shame, which is an affection or passion of the heart whereby a man is grieved and displeased with himself that he hath done any evil. Now, I agree with Perkins that is definitely one of the first things produced in a person. I think his definition of shame could be a bit better, personally. Maybe in his other writings, he describes it in more detail. But he says, shame is an affection of the heart whereby a man is grieved and displeased with himself, that he hath done any evil. That's true, but I think we could go a little deeper. Let me ask you, and again, this is a little intangible, what's shame? If you ever feel ashamed, what is shame? Okay. That was like a heartburn, like, oh. Okay, anybody else? And I get this is intangible. If you're kind of like, but I kind of want to see what you say. What do we think of when we think of shame? If you're ashamed of something you've done. Well, shame often goes together with embarrassment or humiliation. On the one hand, shame has kind of a social aspect to it. It's not just necessarily with humans, but even with God. You can be ashamed before God. For example, we're told in Genesis 2:25, "And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed." They were not ashamed in each other's presence. The idea is not just, you know, they were taking a bath and Adam was over the hill and he couldn't see, and so she's not ashamed, but it was in front of one another that they did not feel shame. There's kind of this other person element to it. Shame is also very much tied up with fear. We'll see shortly that another passion that Perkins mentions is fear, which is true, but fear is a huge part of shame. We often describe being ashamed or embarrassed in terms of fear. What do we say? It was terrifying. I was mortified, right? We often think of it that way. After all, before the fall, Adam and Eve were naked and not ashamed. After the fall, Adam says to God, "I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself." Very much there's this aspect of shame and fear. As I thought about this more and I wrestled with how do you define shame, I think perhaps the essence of shame is being exposed. Being exposed. We've already seen this a bit, but shame and nakedness often go together in Scripture in a very literal way, but also in a spiritual way as well. In fact, shame and nakedness are often interchangeable with one another. For example, God says to Nineveh in Nahum 3:5, "Behold, I am against you, declares the Lord of the hosts, and will lift up your skirts over your face, and I will make nations look at your nakedness and kingdoms at your shame." Notice it's a Hebrew parallel there, nakedness and shame. And notice it's the lifting up of clothing. It's this exposure which reveals, right? The reason, again, why nakedness, at least in front of others, is shameful is that it's exposure. It exposes you. Things that you don't want others to know about you are now known. They become public. This is why it's a very weird, common dream, right? I was in public naked or something like that, right? It's very much this exposure. In terms of the shame produced by our conscience, the nakedness is a spiritual nakedness. Christ says in Revelation 3:17 through 18, "For you say, I am rich, I have prospered, and I need nothing, not realizing that you are wretched, pitiable, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined by the fire so that you may be rich, and white garments so that you may clothe yourself, and the shame of your nakedness may not be seen." When our spiritual or moral nakedness, when we are exposed for who we truly are, that produces shame. I remember you talk about dying from shame, right? I remember when I was in high school, I got in trouble with the law. Little run-in with Johnny Law, okay, and I had to go see a probation officer. And I went down with my parents, and we go to this guy's office. He was the juvenile probation officer guy. He's a really nice guy, totally gifted to be a juvenile probation officer. Very, like, nice, but also put the fear of something in you. Gil Martinez, he's a nice guy. But we go into his office, and in the adjacent office, there's a door between the two, happened to be another man from our church. His name was Pat Beaver, okay? In my hometown, the Beaver family, I know this sounds kind of ridiculous, is like a well, long-established family. There's a Beaver Medical, that's where we went, and he was part of that Dutch family. And he was a very godly, nice man, but as a young man in church, I was very intimidated by him, okay? He probably makes some kids feel, maybe the way that Ruben or maybe Alan Bowley, like not mean men, but they just, when you first, you're like, maybe as a kid, you know what I'm talking about, Dominic, right? Come on, let's be honest. that's shame. He's experiencing shame right now. Anyway. But he was very intimidating, but he was a godly man. Well, Pat was a lieutenant in our police department, and it was his office. And we walked in, and he was on the phone facing the opposite wall, and I was like, oh, he's going to see me any second now. And Gil goes and closes the door, and I'm like, oh. And you have to remember, I played drums in my church. People thought I was a good Christian boy, okay? And at one point, Gil tells me, you go outside in the hallway, I'm going to talk to your parents. And I said, okay. I'm sitting on this wooden bench, and I hear Pat's voice at the end of the hall, and he's going to come my way, and I did like this thing as much as I could do it, and I hear him walking. He has like dress shoes, which kind of click, you know, and it was like a marble floor, and I hear these feet getting closer, closer, and then they come in my peripheral vision, and they stop right in front of me, and they turn, and I looked up, and he said, what are you doing here? As the juvenile probation office sign is like right above me. And I was exposed for who I truly was, right? Not church drummer boy, sinner boy who gets arrested for drinking and things like that. And it was a horrendously mortifying experience. That's shame, right? Who you truly are is now seen in front of people. Furthermore, shame, and this is probably in many ways the primary, or at least it ought to be the primary sense of shame, is between you and God. Knowing that God sees you for who you are. I think this is why the sinful tax collector, when he beat his chest, it says he won't lift up his eyes. The tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. There's this sense of an overwhelming sense of unworthiness, almost uncleanness, we'll see, is associated with this. When Peter realizes that he's talking to the Christ, he says, depart from me, O Lord, right? I'm not worthy to be in your presence. I'm a sinful man, and that is part of shame, knowing that this person now sees who you truly are, okay? So shame is a big one. Next, Perkins says, the second passion is sadness or sorrow. And listen to what he says here, because this is actually really cool. He says, which is commonly thought to be nothing else but melancholy. Now, the older name for clinical depression was melancholy, okay? It's commonly thought to be nothing else but depression, but between them, there is great difference. Sorrow that comes by melancholy ariseth only of that humor annoying the body. Now, they don't necessarily know, but they knew it was somehow related to the body, right? It was somehow connected with your brain or something, right? But this other sorrow ariseth of a man's sin for which his conscience accuseth him. Melancholy may be cured by physic, medicine. But this sorrow produced by the conscience cannot be cured by anything but by the blood of Christ. You know, I think it's helpful there that he distinguishes between normal depression without any relationship to the conscience and that which is produced by the conscience. Sorrow is an enormous part of knowing you did something very, very wrong. Think of David. David, Psalm 31:10, for my life is spent with sorrow and my years with sighing. My strength fails because of my iniquity and my bones waste away, right? Perhaps the most gripping example of the sorrow produced by a condemning conscience is seen in Peter. Matthew 26:75, and Peter remembered the saying of Jesus, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. And he went out and wept bitterly. Peter was a rough, gruff fisherman, and he cried like a baby because of the condemnation of his own conscience. You know, there's so much of what modern psychology tries to heal, and it's really just an accusing conscience, in many ways. All they can do is numb the conscience. Because they are materialists, they look at all psychological problems in many ways through a physical lens. It's a chemical imbalance, right? So if you're torn up by something you did, you're a horrible person. Well, you just need some medication because it's a chemical imbalance. And all that really does in that person is numb them, if it does that at all, right? Or even apart from that, a lot of people who struggle with the condemning conscience, apart from psychology, try to self-medicate themselves, right? Often with alcohol, right? Or it can be all kinds of things, drinking, exercise, shopping. I saw this documentary on Netflix of this man who is incredibly wicked, and he was a philanthropist in many ways, doing all kinds of things, and towards the end they say he was probably trying to do all this out of the guilt of his conscience. And so it can make you do all kinds of things that are ways of us soothing our conscience, but at the end of the day, only the blood of Christ can take it. I like how Perkins says that. This sorrow produced by the conscience cannot be cured by anything but by the blood of Christ. Not cured, maybe numbed by some things, but not cured by the blood of Christ. So sorrow is a huge one. Perkins continues. The third is fear. Fear. In causing whereof, conscience is very forcible. Now, what he means by that is the force of fear produced in an accusing, condemning conscience is very powerful, right? Very, very powerful. He says, if a man had all the delights and pleasures that heart can wish, they cannot do him any good if conscience be guilty. Belshazzar, when he was in the midst of all his delights and saw the handwriting upon the wall, his countenance changed, his thoughts troubled him, his joints loosed, and his knees smote together. Now, on the one hand, we've seen that the fear produced by a guilty conscience is connected to shame, the fear of being exposed or the fear of experiencing that, right? That's definitely part of it. On the other hand, a big part of it is not the fear of exposure, but the fear of judgment, the fear of judgment, either in this life or more in terms of the life to come, right? And notice, these are not necessarily the same things. Someone might be absolutely mortified for others to know what they did, but not really be afraid of the judgment to come, right? Someone might be terrified of the judgment to come, but maybe the shame aspect doesn't bother them as much. In each particular person, the passions produced are slightly different in some people, right? All right. Let's see here. Now we'll see later when we talk about the good affections produced, caused in the soul by an excusing conscience when it does so rightly, right? One of those effects is boldness. Boldness and confidence between you and God, but also before men as well. It produces that. The converse of that, though, is fear, right? This is why, or for example, in terms of the boldness, this is why Paul can say things, very bold things, like, with me it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself. That boldness is the boldness of a good conscience, right? The opposite is fear, though, particularly fear of judgment. For example, turn with me to 1 John 4, 16 through 18. As I sip from my flowery cup. 1 John 4, 16 through 18. John says, so we have come to know and to believe the love that God has for us. God is love, and whoever abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. By this is love perfected with us, so that we may have confidence for the day of judgment. Because as he is, so also are we in this world. Now, notice, when he says, by this is love perfected with us, he's speaking about what's mentioned in the previous verse, namely, abiding in God's love. When you abide in his love through, you know, faith in the gospel promises of God's love, his love is perfected within you, meaning he produces a love within you for himself and gives you a greater assurance of his own love for you. Okay? Notice then, when you abide in God's love and his love is perfected in us, he goes on to say, a fruit of that is that we have confidence or boldness for the day of judgment. We do not fear the coming of our Lord. How could we? He loves us. This is our beloved, and it's the greatest joy of our life. We go to see him. Our sins are forgiven, and we have a great sense of his love, and we love him, and so we have confidence and not fear, right? You know, those people in your life who you have, there's great love between you, you have the greatest confidence and boldness between them, right? To maybe ask, maybe you can press someone for something more. There's much more boldness and intimacy in your fellowship and love because that love exists. And so we because we're perfected in his love by abiding in his love, we have great confidence in the day of judgment. It's not a day of fear. He continues in verse 18, there is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment, and whoever fears has not been perfected in love. Okay, note, if you fear primarily in terms of the day of judgment, right, it's a fearful day for you, that's proof you've not been perfected in love. Because if you've been perfected in love by abiding in God's love, you have great confidence for the day of judgment. You see this kind of juxtaposition between the two. One is confidence, the other is fear. As we'll see, you know, for a Christian, it's not necessarily the fear of perhaps being cast into hell, right? But the fear that, you know, I will receive a very low place in the kingdom of heaven for having lived so foolishly in this life, you know? My reward, I chose my reward in this life. And because of that, even though a Christian may know they're saved, they may still in their conscience wince a little bit when they think of the return of their Lord, right? And so even that shows they've not been perfected in love, which is a fruit of not abiding in his love. If they had abided in his love, not only would that have helped them overcome that sin, but give them a greater sense of assurance, right? And so fear is the opposite of confidence, and it is also produced by a guilty conscience. Now, interestingly, in another sense, with a guilty conscience, it's not just a fear of judgment and punishment, but Scripture speaks about the fear of a guilty conscience as kind of spreading, like almost like a gangrene, and taking hold of a person almost entirely so that they totally live in fear, right? Imagine the life of a criminal on the run, never being able to let your guard down. Maybe you hear the sound of car brakes when you're sitting in your living room. Your heart starts racing. Why? Well, that could be the police. Who's outside my door? You know what I mean? You're constantly living in fear. And that's kind of true of sinners as well. Perhaps, wow, this is going to be the judgment of God upon me. This is how he's going to deal with me here. I really like what Perkins says. Listen, this is really funny. Yea, the guilty conscience will make a man afraid if he see but a worm peep out of the ground, or a silly creature to go cross his way, meaning like a black cat, right? Or something that you're like, this is God's condemnation of me. Or if he but see his own shadow all of a sudden. Proverbs 28:1, the wicked fleeth when no man pursueth, but the righteous are bold as a lion, right? You know, it's interesting. There's an old Roman proverb that says, conscientia crimen prodit. Conscientia crimen prodit. Conscience betrays guilt. Conscience betrays guilt. A fearful, guilty conscience is very hard to hide. You've perhaps seen it in your own children at times. They're doing something they were not supposed to be doing. You walk into the room and they have the deer in the headlights look. If they're really bad liars, they're like, I wasn't doing anything. And you're like, now I know you were doing something. I wasn't going to think you were, but now it's obvious, right? Their guilt betrayed that they were definitely doing something. On another level, there are whole books and departments of study in criminology devoted to the detection of guilt by basically reading the signs of turmoil in someone, perhaps reading their body language, polygraphs, you know, watching heart rate as you interview them, because a guilty conscience, even if they're really good actors, only people who can really pull that off are people with a seared conscience who are truly sociopaths. We'll look at that. I don't know that all sociopaths are necessarily, I don't know that all seared consciences are necessarily sociopaths, but there's definitely a part of conscience lacking in sociopaths. But they can pass a polygraph because their conscience is truly not bothered. They in fact, often they have this incredible narcissism. And so they can even have, I've even seen them say to themselves, well, actually what I did in killing all those women was a good thing because they were just streetwalkers. I'm actually a good person, right? And so they're, that we'll see, that's an extreme case of an erring conscience where your conscience is excusing when it ought to be accusing, right? But typically in most people, it'll give them away. In fact, it's really interesting. You know, there's videos on YouTube you can watch if you're interested. I could probably find these where it's a criminologist narrating a police interrogation, probably like for the purposes of learning how to do this and teaching teaching future law enforcement, right? But if you watch these guys who work in these interrogations, all they're doing is masterfully working with a conscience. It's amazing if you look at it. And they're working at this conscience to try to get a little something. And then they'll get a little bit something more till they have the person finally break down and weep and give a confession. It's interesting. They'll often start out excusing the person's behavior to some degree. They'll say, just tell us what happened. Did she attack the children? Is that what happened? And then maybe you pushed her, she fell over and hit her head, and then you got scared and had to try to hide the body. Is that what happened? And sometimes they'll give in to that because they know they're so busted, they'll say, yeah, that's what happened. Because their conscience will allow them to do that, right? And then the investigator turns and they go, okay, look, you're not being entirely honest with us. We know what actually happened. Come on, you need to tell us. You will feel so much better if you get this off your chest. Man, they're masterfully working with this conscience. It could be done dangerously in somebody manipulating. You know, interrogations can be manipulative too, but they can also, if properly done, really just you're working a person's conscience to get them to finally confess. Their conscience is screaming out to them, confess so I can have peace, right? And they can appeal to that as well, but they'll often get them on the hook with, yeah, I did push them down. And they'll say, okay, well then, you know, why did we find evidence that they were stabbed or something? And then they just, you know, they're not their friend, but they work that way. It's just fascinating that it's dealing with conscience. Okay, the fourth thing. Perkins says, the fourth is desperation. Desperation. Desperation is really hopelessness. That's literally what it means in Latin, without hope, right? He says, the fourth is desperation, whereby a man, through the vehement and constant accusation of his conscience, comes to be out of all hope of the pardon of sins, or at least thinks they are, right? This made Saul, Ahithophel, and Judas to hang themselves. And he says this, this makes many in our day to do the like as appeareth by the declarations of such as have been presented when they were about to hang or drown themselves or to cut their own throats, meaning they left a suicide note or something. Maybe they said something to someone else, meaning I have no hope of the pardon of my sins, or what I have done is so bad, the only peace I can imagine is from release of my conscience is death, right? Interestingly, we don't have time to go. There's so many like good conscience quotes we could talk about. The whole famous speech of Shakespeare of Hamlet, to be or not to be, is kind of an inner dialogue with his own conscience of a situation like this. When things are so bad, he basically says, like, why would someone suffer the pains of a weary life? He says, but that the dreams that may come from sleep, meaning what happens after death, and then at the very end he says, thus conscience makes cowards of us all, right? It's this idea of you're also afraid to go before the judge as well. Sadly, this is just as true for us today, that so many people are absolutely living in hopelessness because of their condemning conscience. They might try to live a very dissolute life, really just a full-blown alcoholic, full-blown drug addict, whatever, to numb the pain. And in the worst cases, that doesn't even work, and they even attempt to kill themselves. I think one of the craziest accounts of this, even more hardcore than John Bunyan's, this was experienced by some believers before they came to Christ. The Lord prevented them. But the most hardcore account was of the English particular Baptist of the 1800s, John Warburton. I think I've read his story to you several times. I don't know that I've read this particular part. He went through a period of months under intense condemnation. His conscience awoke through the preaching of the law. We'll see, that's kind of related to all this. A conscience can be sleeping and be stirred awake again. That's what Paul also means when he says, and then the law came, and sin came to life, and I died. All these things are very connected with one another. But he was just living like a total pagan, loved drinking, without a care in his mind for God, probably thought he was a good person, conscience totally sleeping. And then he went into town one day because the church had a new organ, right? This is like before TV or internet or anything. This was great entertainment. He liked organ music. So he went to go hear, and he says, into the pulpit walked a man who had preached a text, a horrifying text of sermons when he was a child. And that man's text was, be not deceived, God is not mocked, for whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. And with that sermon began a months-long process of God bringing him to the end of himself because of a condemning conscience. But he says that during this time, it was so bad, he fell into what Perkins would describe as desperation, even almost bringing himself to kill himself. He writes, I had frequently before this time had many powerful temptations to put an end to my miserable life, but now I was fully determined to do it. For a thought struck my mind that the longer I lived in the world, the more sin I should commit. And the more sin I committed, the greater would be my damnation. So that I concluded the sooner I did the deed, the less sin I should have to answer for. Several times I went into my bedroom with my razor, being fully determined to cut my throat. But instead of so doing, was always obliged to always fall upon my knees and implore the Lord that if it were possible, he would show mercy to one so vile as I. And then again, a fresh sight of the justice of God in a righteous law brought me to believe it was as impossible for God to have mercy upon me as for him to cease to exist. And in fact, the day before, the night before he was finally saved, and hearing his salvation story, he said he was like listening, like, and he said the people next to him were like, stop it, right? But you can understand a man thinking it's better to just die and go to hell, finally finding the hope of and the joy of salvation. It produces incredible joy, and we'll see that's part of the good affections produced by an excusing conscience, is joy and hope, right? But sadly for many, it really is for many, I don't want to use this word lightly, but a hellish existence to live under a tremendously condemning conscience, and yet to think, but if I kill myself now, I go to the judge. But then also to think, like he did, might as well get it over with. I'm not living, it's better just to go and live in it finally than to live in this fear, right? But that's all produced by a condemning conscience. Lastly, fifthly, Perkins says, the last is a perturbation or disquietness of the whole man, whereby all the powers and faculties of the whole soul are out of order. Isaiah 57, 20 through 21. But the wicked are like the tossing sea. It cannot keep quiet, and its waters toss up mire and dirt. There is no peace, says my God, for the wicked. Right? Kind of generally, you could lump all those things together. Shame, fear, I always forget the second one, sorrow, even sorrow as bad as desperation, all that is just kind of a disordering of oneself. Well, those are the five passions that are caused by a condemning conscience. He interestingly doesn't mention guilt, but I think that's because he basically understands it in terms of fear. And he calls it a guilty conscience, a fearful conscience. And I think in many ways, guilt is a collection of all of these, right? It's kind of along these lines as well. Note, as I said, you know, these different passions will arise differently in different people. Some might have a tremendous sense of shame because others know about it, but not really have any fear of, at least of God, right? Let's say no one knew about it. Well, they might just go on living joyfully, thinking I'm a good person, but if that sin comes out, they'll feel more shame, right? Some might be really given to sorrow. It might really lead to sorrow more than others, where in others it might lead to fear. But in any soul, these will all happen to some extent, okay? Therefore, it is a horrible thing to have a condemning conscience. This is why Paul says, be subject to the governing authorities, not just because it's good to do so, but for conscience sake. Like, don't ruin your conscience. Why experience these things? A condemning conscience is often described, or the passions produced in someone as being cut in the heart, or having one's heart strike them. We're told in 1 Samuel 24:5, and afterward, David's heart struck him because he had cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Or after Peter's sermon in Acts 2, we're told, now when they heard this, they were cut to the heart and said to Peter and the rest of the apostles, brothers, what shall we do? Consider the account of a guilty conscience in Psalm 32. He says, for when I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My strength was dried up as by the heat of the summer, Selah. And he goes on to say, I acknowledged my sin to you, and I did not cover my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the iniquity of my sin, Selah. It's the release that comes from a cleared conscience. We'll talk about this next week, but oh man, it is so good to get sin off of your conscience clean, right? If you've been carrying something within you, maybe hiding something for a long time, when you finally get rid of that, people describe it as a huge weight being lifted, right? And this weight often leads to joy. I think this is what's being described in Psalm 51:10. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me. Make my spirit right again. It's disordered. There's the perturbation that Perkins speaks about. There's no peace. Renew a right spirit within me. Let me have peace in my conscience again. Okay? Well, that is it for today. We will consider next the good affections produced by an excusing, comforting conscience. We'll see. In many ways, you could look at conscience through the lens of law and gospel as well. Much of this is the effects of the law, and we'll see the preaching of the law is good for the stirring of the conscience, right? And yet the hope primarily of an excusing conscience comes from the gospel. And let me just say, if you are experiencing any of these things within you, maybe you need to confess sin to someone, maybe especially to the Lord. Remember especially, Perkins says, the guilt for a guilty the cure for a guilty conscience is especially the blood of Christ. When your conscience condemns you, makes you ashamed, sorrowful, or fearful, or desperate, disquieted, the only remedy that will truly give your conscience rest, and not just numb it, is the blood of Jesus received freely by faith, whether for the first time by a new believer or the reapplication of it again by a seasoned believer. It's always the blood of Christ that we look to by faith. Okay? Any questions? Comments? I think so. I mean, they experience all those things. Yeah, I think there's kind of a lack of self-awareness there. Like, I think a child can feel guilt, but maybe not have the self-reflection to know, well, this is my conscience working within me. They don't know how it happened. They just know they feel that way, you know? So, yeah, I definitely think that's so. I wouldn't be surprised in many ways before my own deeper understanding of conscience, I tended to identify it more with the feelings than with being, you know, produced by a faculty of my soul. So I would say so. We'll also see, and this is where it'll get more complicated next week, a conscience can err. A conscience can excuse when it ought not. A conscience can condemn when it ought not. And so we'll see what Perkins says, saying like when your conscience excuses when it ought not. At the end of the day, God is the Lord of the conscience. Conscience is not Lord. That's why we'll get into that part of the confession, because he says, evil be evil, though conscience say otherwise 1,000 times, right? So we'll look into that, and we'll get more into the gospel encouragement. We'll see how complex it can be. A Christian's conscience can condemn and excuse. And there's this turmoil, particularly, that can only happen in a regenerated believer, because they now have love for God and they do truly stand pardoned before God, and they can know that, and yet they just did something very sinful, and so there's this turmoil that happens within them. And so we'll consider that next week, okay? All right, with no more questions, you guys are excused.